Maybe just give an introduction, because I think there's a few that haven't been on the telecon before. So we've been doing these sort of monthly telecons of people in the carbon monitoring system program that are doing projects related to atmospheric validation, so top-down studies. So it's been a few months since we had our last one, which was in October. But we had the in-person science team meeting in November. So some of you were there, I guess some weren't, but we had a little discussion about the working group and what we wanted to be doing, and in general we seemed quite happy with the telecons, so we'll plan to keep them going over this year at about a monthly basis, so we could keep this time, sort of the first week of the month, Wednesday, 10 o'clock Pacific. And then, so the next one would be March 4th, and I don't have a speaker yet, but I'll let you know by email. And then we talked also a little bit about getting together for an in-person meeting, and one potential suggestion for that would be around the time of the NOAA Global Monitoring Conference in May. So we could also take some other suggestions about when and where to do an in-person meeting, so we could talk about that a bit at the end, as well as take suggestions over email and then maybe talk about that next month in a bit more detail. So it's just a bit of introduction, and then I'll hand it over to Dubé, who will give us a presentation about some of his work at the Four Corners and using the mobile FTS. So thanks, Dubé.
Okay. Can I get started? No questions from Heather or any suggestions? Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, so I think I hope everybody has the slides, so I'll just follow through them. I'm Dubé. I have a NASA CMS project on sort of validating and calibrating and developing an operational protocol for mobile FTS, the low-resolution FTS that was developed by Karlsruhe, and now several people have bought one, including Harvard and Caltech, and we've been taking that side by side to the TCON stations and doing comparisons. Today I'll actually talk a little bit, at the end I'll summarize you. All I can say is the comparisons are very, very promising, and I was at Karlsruhe, and the Cocoon network, that we call it Cocoon, is taken off, and hopefully there'll be a lot of gaps filled on these things. So I call these things, in the title, I talked a little about it. So we're talking about high-frequency mesoscale atmospheric observations, and they address both the climate carbon cycle, carbon couple climate, carbon climate modeling, as well as issues of verification of fluxes of CO2, as well as potential constraining emissions of methane and hydrocarbons from enhanced oil and gas activities. So just to give you a quick, so I'll focus a little bit more on TCON type of measurements. And these questions are kind of motivate our work, and the questions were several years ago, and they still persist, is can we verify CO2 emissions at a national level for trading or a treaty? And I'll sort of discuss some of that aspect from the Four Corners Power Plant Emission Attribution Study that we did over the last 4 years. The other question that I'll address that's coming up is can we quantify methane leaks from fossil fuel infrastructure? And here again, I will present some results from the Four Corners on measurements and modeling to show that there's a low bias of inventories. In terms of measurements, there's been a lot of work by many groups, and there are some observational challenges. One is that in-situ measurements that are actually very, very, that have been going on for a while, I'm going to say ground, there's large meteorological variability in the, the noise, and so that's a challenge. You have to intelligently, coordinate your measurements around meteorology and winds, downwind, upwind, and from the ground it gets pretty hard. And then from the satellites we have this low-frequency sampling, you do daily, sampling, but your revisit time may be tens of days, so that's a challenge. So the tool of choice that's new, and other people have done similar work, is using sonar absorption spectroscopy from the ground with instruments like the TCON, the FTS, and Pandora, and there could be others. But the key point here is they give you a mean mesoscale level column measurement of greenhouse gases and air pollutants like NO2, and that gives you a sort of, the mean gives you an average and gets around this meteorological variability a little bit, but you still have to understand the winds. So I'll talk a little bit about that. So that's kind of the key observational method we're using here. The other thing is we can find doing high resolution forward modeling with inventory as our tool to test the analysis. And we also use empirical tracer-tracer relationships for emission factor verification. I'm going to jump through some of the motivation because time is, or I only have half an hour. So the motivation essentially is, the CO2 is going up. It will force climate, and it's a centennial level problem. The carbon cycle is complicated, and you get ups and downs. So I'll switch through based on uptake. But the secular increase is pretty clear and driven by anthropogenic emissions. There's a whole issue of the third slide is we know today half of the CO2 goes back into the ocean, the biosphere. The various where exactly what is still complicated, and the whole question is in terms of the natural carbon cycle as we drive the CO2 up and change the climate. Will this nature continue to buffer our ability or reduce that? So that's a big problem that everybody's, and OCO2 is up there that should help in this regard. The other gas of interest is methane, as you know, and that ties into the second part of the talk. Methane also has increased, and there the range of sources is highly complex, and you can see recently after a kind of plateau and a short drop in 2060, the emission has risen again. It's fair to say that we don't know the budget and the baseline as well as we do about CO2. The fourth slide just gives you a sort of a picture of what the methane lifetime is and what the sources are. And the point is really to show you that it is very, very complex. And again, the global warming potential of methane on a 100-year time compared to CO2 on the same time constants is about 25. So it's a more potent greenhouse gas. It has a complex than CO2. It has a complex mix of sources, and there's considerable uncertainty both in the amounts and the trends in there. And fossil fuels account to about 30% or so of the sources. Again, just to give you a forecast, there's a lot of concern for the various IPCC scenarios. And this shows you the four scenarios, the optimistic, which is RCP 2.6 versus business as usual. And the point here is this is absolutely a source of concern. And the key point is overlaid on these data are the black points, which is the real data in the past. And you can see we have kind of hugged the high-end scenario. So that's the whole cause of concern that nothing that technology has done has reduced it. The next slide actually gives you a very quick summary of what the emissions, national emissions, look like. And on the top, you can see that today China is basically the number one CO2 emitter, and the rise is dramatic, so it's almost an exponential there. So the mix from going from Kyoto in 1990 or so to Paris in 2015, the whole mix of national emissions has changed dramatically. And I think as we go into Paris, we need to recognize that. It's noteworthy that per capita emissions in China are now the same as Europe. So I think it's an important thing that is being revisited. And as we all know, that at least China and U.S. have kind of have a bilateral sort of commitment to China will peak its emissions in 2030 or so. So coming back to China, I think since it's driving a lot of the emissions and the global economy is coupled, this is a paper in Nature that came out by Chinese authors, and this kind of tells you that if you look at the provincial Chinese emissions, which is adding up all the states versus the national, which is the Chinese government reporting, there's a big gap there. So the numbers don't add up even within China, and this is a pretty big gap, about 1.4 gigatons in 2010, and that pertains to the uncertainty in reporting at the national level. this kind of motivated some activity within DOE labs, NNSA labs, NASA JPL, and NOAA, as well as the national academies, that can we, if there is a climate tree, this was during Copenhagen where there were a lot of concerns about verification being raised by the Chinese and access to, you know. So national academies wrote a report, as did this consortium of NNSA, JPL, and DOE labs on the needs to detect and infer emissions from small humans, you know, signals of CO2 over large and variable background, which should now be 400 ppm, by the way, in complex flows from afar. You know, it's a long list, so you need to understand transport. And then there's a lack of spatiotemporally resolved good inventories. So I think that was the motivation. And so what we do with TOI, so a lot of work is being done, and I'll switch a little bit to the TCON, which I think Heather talked about, Gretchen talked about a while back. But essentially, TCON is a network of direct solar absorption instruments that have been very well calibrated with airborne and other techniques, and basically looks directly at the sun and does direct solar absorption. And the intent is to validate satellites, including GOSAT, OCO2, and others in the past and to come. Here I give you just the precisions reported by TCON. They're fairly good. So the key for the TCON is the protocols are pretty stringent, and the operation protocols are also very rigid. So we follow and get the most in the column CO2 precisions. And we measure column CO2s because there is a slight advantage to using them as constraints, because models, it's recognized models have a hard time doing the boundary layer height, right, those kind of short-term dynamics. So doing the column gets, you know, it forgives you a little bit on those errors. The column being precisely provides a better constraint. So we can do CO2 precision of 0.8 or so ppm in accuracy, methane to 5 ppb, as well as other greenhouse gases. Next slide gives you a kind of a what has come out over the last decade from TCON or so or more. And this is about 20 stations all over the world distributed with some gaps, as you can see, in Asia and South America and Africa. Some of these gaps are being filled, and I'll come to the end with this EM27 sun. That's kind of the motivation of our CMS project. What is shown here is just typical data at the TCON sites, and you can see the Keeling curve essentially being captured on sort of the mesoscale data sets for carbon. So I think this is really nice, and it's been used very effectively, as we heard, to begin to construct large-scale carbon cycle land models. What I will focus now next is on what was new for us, is instead of looking at the natural carbon cycle on seasonal and decadal scales, which the analysis has done, we're kind of looking at more short-term variability. And so we actually deployed for verification of emissions, we picked four corners. This is the next slide. I don't have the numbers. This is the four corners site. The site was selected because it's in between two big power plants, the San Juan and Four Corners power plants, which emit a lot of, I think they're the single largest point NOx emitters if you add them up, and also pretty big CO2 emitters. And so we located our station in between these two power plants. They're about 10 kilometers apart. And this is a picture of RFDS, which was TCON, and we measured all these gases, carbon dioxide, methane, CO, N2O, and water, every 2 minutes during the day. So these are high-frequency mesoscale column measurements, and that's the location. I've also shown a lot of these gas oil activities and wells. There's also, which I've not shown, there's a lot of coal bed methane in the same region. This is just a picture of what our site looked like. We've now actually, some stuff is still there, but most of our system is down in the Amazon for carbon cycle science for the last 5 months or so. It's been operational. So so this is kind of a picture taken a while back, a couple of years ago. So we have this TCON station. We also have NASA Goddard has a Pandora that directly measures NO2 and ozone on the same sort of, if you may, mesoscale line of sight solar paths. We also had a Brewer ozone sensor from NOAA. There are a lot of Picaros, you know, measuring all the greenhouse gases and isotopes, meteorological sensors, and we're co-located with an EPA site. This is the San Juan Power Station site, which measures the atmospheric pollutants. Next slide shows you, so as part of this problem, since we are analyzing mesoscale data, we actually, and a colleague, Keely Costigan here, developed a nested wharf chem model customized for Four Corners, and we basically, for the CO2 verification, used real-time hourly SEMS emissions reported to the EPA from the two power plants, and also used the NEI urban inventory for the you know, for the whole region. And so this gives you, we ran down to about 300 meter or so resolution in the horizontal. So so I'll show you some simulations results in the next slide. Here you see a sample plume, and you can see that on the left-hand side is the CO2 plume for that period, and on the right-hand side is the NO2 plume. So I think we actually verified, and our sites are in the black dot, and we actually, this was an instant where we could see a pretty big signal in our site, so we were sure that the model was doing a pretty reasonable job for this period.
Hey, again, this is John Miller. Just had a question. So what were the flux boundary conditions that you used, the surface fluxes for these runs? Where did those come from?
The emissions, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, so this is the SEMS power plants. Those are the two big power plants that we're in. And then there was the NEI urban inventory that we used.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. And so, and this work was done by somebody who worked with me for,
Oh, sorry, this is Jinji. How about the biosphere fluxes? Do you have any?
We did not use any biosphere fluxes there. So we just, the region is, at least the region where we're at, if you downscale, the inner domains are pretty barren. So this is kind of a desert.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's a good question, because I think that's something that would need to be included in areas like Boston and more vegetated areas.
Okay, thank you.
But that's a good point. Thank you. So, coming back to the simulations, just illustrative simulations, you can see that both CO2 and NO2 does go over to NOI, so the chemistry, it matters, and so you see a little bit different. CO2 is basically a passive tracer and follows transfer. You can see those differences. The next slide is kind of data which we are very proud of, because and this paper actually showed up in PNAS last year, Radhika Lindenmeyer et al. And what I'm showing you here is basically, I would say, a pretty intense chemical interrogation of the plume on the mesoscale in the column. On the left hand, so the plots here are basically plots for all the gases, CO2, the isotope of CO2, NO2, CO, del-13 CO2, and the meteorology during a plume event. So plumes come in and out the field of your, you know, your sensor, and also of the in-situ sensor. The cyan lines, the colored lines, are the in-situ data, and the cyan lines, the bluish cyan lines, are all the in-situ data, and the other colors are the various gases. What you can see at blush is that both the in-situ and the column data correlate fairly well. There are some differences because they're measuring things, but there are some structure, but they correlate fairly well for all the gases. You get pretty big signals in the left-hand side is the in-situ scale. So you're getting basically 80 to 100 ppm increases in CO2. Large increases, you know, 30 ppb increases in NO2 in situ, and obviously smaller increases in the column. For example, the column CO2 is going up by about 8 ppm. So I think this data shows you the kind of typical, and we have many, many plumes that we have intercepted, but this is the kind of data we can then analyze with our model. So this is the data we get. And by the way, people interested in del-13 is it's challenging to do del-13. The signals are low, but if you actually calibrated with the on-site in-situ sensor we did, you could semi-empirically reproduce the Dell 13. And this is something Tcon is going after. I think there's hope, but what we learned was because of the averaging kernels in the vertical are very different, one has to be very careful, and this would be something that would require a lot more sort of validation at Tcon sites. So next, let me now give you the results. Oh, sorry. We also had a Picaro there, and what this shows you really is if you do a Keeling plots of Dell 13 versus of the power plant plume, no surprise, you get a Dell 13 of minus 26 per mil, which is basically dominated by the coal emissions because that's what we're measuring, and we basically match measurements of coal in that region that are published. So that was nice to be able to verify that, and this is no surprise. These are in-situ measurements. I'm going to show you the verification later. This is actually the NO2 to CO2 ratio, and this is sort of source attribution. As I told you, I didn't tell you before, these two power plants that are shown here that are east of these Bloomfield and Farmington, the San Juan power plant that is sort of east of our site, and the Four Corners plant that is south of our site, they have very different emissions. The San Juan plant that is on New Mexico state land has got much more advanced scrubbing technology because they were kind of pushed to invest more money in their scrubbers in the past, whereas the Four Corners plant is managed by Arizona, but it's on Indian land, and the pressures to do scrubbing were less so they don't have scrubbers. So the NOx to CO2 ratio of Four Corners is much higher than that of San Juan. So what I show here is basically, again, mesoscale measurements measured by the Pandora, in this case, the NO2 that's in the vertical, and the Tcon, the CO2 in the horizontal. And what you can see, this is column amounts of CO2 and NO2. And you can see clearly the slopes are the emission factors, and when the wind comes in from the east, which is when you're sampling the basically San Juan plume, your slopes, the NO2 to CO2 is a lot steeper than when you I misspoke here. So when the winds are from the south, that is the Four Corners plants, the slopes are a lot steeper. There's some mixture from the urban site, which is also going to be steeper NOx emissions because transportation also emits more NOx. But when they are from the San Juan plant, the slopes are a lot lower. So we can sort of do this emission factor verifications at the mesoscale with these column measurements. And again, it's textbook for in-situ work, but it's nice that this can also be done remotely. We also captured some fires, and no surprise, when we do those emissions, that's the bottom panel, the emissions of NO2 are a lot lower even from the fires. And when we have windy, clean day, which means when the signal blows away, we don't see much data. So obviously we need to, for this analysis, we use the measured meteorology to interpret the results. And this NO2 and CO2 plumes actually are pretty extensive. They're not, they exist. They give mesoscale signals. They're no longer just in the point. Okay, so this next slide actually is kind of verification. So here what I show you is come back. The blacks are the CO2 data measured by the FDS, and the reds are kind of the WRF model, which was constrained, as I asked before, by the SENS emission and the NEI inventory. The lesson learned here is WRF has issues, but I think in this for this plume interception, on the left, profile 0 is basically the beginning of the plume in the morning, and 40 is the end, so that's time, and the vertical is the simulated and the measured CO2. We were actually able to show that the agreement between the SEMS input WRF model and the FDS observed was to within 5%. So I think that's kind of promising that the high frequency measurements with a model that can capture the meteorology reasonably well forward model can verify emissions to within 5% or so. And that's at least in this case. Close this chapter here. Our FDS is now actually operating in Manaus, Brazil. We actually had a target yesterday, a second target. The first target, there was some cloud cover, but I think yesterday, the OCO target should be pretty good. So we've been running there for about 4 months now, and we are looking forward towards sort of using our data to understand better the tropical Amazon carbon cycle. So just to give you, so the instrument is no longer in Four Corners. We still have the Pandora working there. I know that NOAA people are going to do a campaign, Gabby and Tom and Eric. And so we still have a footprint there that we can leverage for ground support activities. The Pandora is working there, and we have a trailer there with power and in-situ stuff going on. Okay, now let me switch gears to this methane issue, and I'll again cut the motivation source. As you know, from gas in the pump, America is pretty much producing a lot of oil and gas, and largely because of this hydraulic fracturing where they pump in a lot of fluids underground and do horizontal drilling, and that gets a lot of this gas that was previously inaccessible and oil out of there. So gas has become a pretty – and oil from fracking has become a pretty a big growth area in the U.S., and there are also concerns associated with it, shown on the right, is, you know, you could basically have many pathways, geological as well as from the infrastructure to mine and distribute the methane. And so that's a pretty important topic here. Just a quick summary, the gas is fundamentally good. It's less polluting than coal, relative to coal, and also emits about half as much CO2 per unit energy produced as coal. So it's better than coal. Some people will say it could be a bridge technology to carbon neutrality. But there's a lot of concerns about fugitive methane leaks and obviously groundwater issues, which are highly uncertain and very sensitive issue. Methane is 25 times more potent to greenhouse gas than CO2 on a 100-year time constant. And roughly, if you do the numbers, methane leaks need to be kept below 3% for it to be sort of better than coal in terms of a greenhouse gas forcing basis. There are other issues of hydrocarbon leaks and rigs and activity and direct emissions that locate polluted air, and so that's a pretty important topic. And, there's a lot of top-down measurements that suggest that these leaks, and I'll show you a summary next one. Now, DOE is kind of the owner of the energy part of that, and Muniz, who was at MIT, kind of we recognize the environmental challenges, but I think we need to manage them because and that's the pragmatic side of it. Again, there's regulations that are under development. Some have been enforced, and we need to have baselines and really know what things are reporting. So this is an area where all of us can need to play a role. This next slide actually gives you inventories and emission factors, and what is plotted here, this is from a Brand Science Review recently, that shows you the ratio, which is the top-down measured divided by the bottoms-up inventory, at a range of scales, sort of from small emissions from individual joints to large play-scale emissions on the top. And the key point is, from this point, is all the top-down studies demonstrate they're all greater than one, and they range from, 1.5 to 7. So top-down measurements are suggesting that there is a significant underestimate of emissions from these oil and gas activities. At the time when we started the work, actually, we were working with NASA JPL a little bit, and we saw this plot a while back, and what this shows is it's a highly processed, and Christian Frankenberg did most of this analysis, methane data from the Skamaki satellite data. These are very average data, like 2003 to 2009, but in this data you can clearly see the reds, which are sort of higher CO2 in the 20 ppb or so level, I think. But what leaps out to you are these oil and gas basins where there's a lot of oil and gas activity. In the Permian, there's a lot of hydraulic fracturing already gone off, as is in Wyoming in the Powder River Basin. San Juan actually has not experienced a dramatic surge, and yet it is happening now. It's been dominated by coal and gas. So when we look at this data, we first thought they're highly averaged, they're satellite data, and so we had to get some ground truth on these. So we actually started working with Christian and Eric and others to see what whether we could verify at least at San Juan, the Four Corners region where we had FTS after the site. So I'll talk a little bit about that. This paper was Cort et al. That came up in GRN last year. So in Four Corners, just a quick summary, it's actually the largest coal bed methane production area in the U.S., produces about 27 teragrams per year, so it's a pretty significant source in 2007, and it's shown on the right in terms of plots. The red is San Juan, and the dashed lines are all the 17 coals. So San Juan Basin basically dominates coal bed methane production in the nation, and it's a huge flux. So, you know, I think that's one. And it's, again, what we did was I'll revisit this data a little bit. This is the same data where on the left is the satellite data seen by Skiamaki, highly averaged, 2003 to 2009. And zoomed in is the FDS site, so we can see the signals roughly. And overlaid is the on the right-hand side is the Edgar inventory. So to no surprise, you can see the Edgar inventory does recognize coal and gas activity there, and it has a source on the right-hand side. What the next slide actually shows you, Skiamaki sees this hot spot in space, and what we had is that we were doing high-frequency measurements in the 10-kilometer mesoscale in time, and so here is what we saw over basically more than 2 years. A summary of diurnal profiles of methane, and if you look at these plots from sunrise to sunset, you see that methane signals tend to be high in the morning and fall off during the afternoon. So this pattern we basically think and then attribute to the change in the meteorology. So what you're having is in the morning there is a high signal that is from wind is blowing from basically the southeast where you have a lot of these coal bed and oil and gas activities, and the signals are of the order of 50 ppb. So we were able to kind of see the signal in time that Skiamaki saw in space and make conclusions on the emissions based on these. And again, as I said, these when it's very windy, we don't see the signal. So we see this diurnal signal early morning in methane for about 70% of the days or more. So this is a pretty robust signal. So what we did next is we actually ran the WARF model with the meteorology first, the column methane enhancement. Sunrise to sunset, that's UTC, left is sunrise, right is sunset. And you can see that the model does see this pattern, the blue lines, albeit much more damped, a much more smaller amplitude. And if you scale the amplitude by a factor of 3, you get sort of agreement with the FDS data. So this is kind of our broad brush evidence that the regional scale inventory in the Four Corners radius, in this case Edgar, was off by a factor of 3. Okay, so that's the TCON data. When you scale by a factor of 3, you can match the TCON data. The same applies for the satellite data. So we did the same analysis of the satellite data where we plot the Skiamaki observed enhancement by the WARF model observed enhancement in the column. And the slope of that line is about 3.5. So that gives us the factor that we think the regional scale Edgar inventory is off by. And we estimated, based on the emissions, what that amounts to. That amounts to about 0.6 teragrams of methane missing, actually, from that region. This data was not presented in some other studies. I'm just trying to point to some references that are coming out. So I think there's an older study in PNAS that actually had the opposite direction because there was no data. I mean, your inversion model will be as good as your data, but in this case, the inversion model, Miller et al. Said in their paper that the Edgar emissions were too high in Four Corners. Turner et al. Actually have used our data and the GOSAT data. This paper is actually going to be in ACPD soon. Many of you have seen it. it rectifies that, and actually it agrees with using both GoSat and our data. So I think it's important to do be careful about inverse modeling in both sort of sensitive and data poor region. You know. Okay, the last slide here on this Four Corners work is actually stuff that's not published, and this is I'm writing it up now. But this is kind of the TCON FTS we have. We actually added a mid IR channel to our instrument that allows us to actually look at gases, hydrocarbons like ethane on the regional scale, column mesoscale. And here what I'm showing you is simultaneous measurements, almost simultaneously, they're oscillating within 2 minutes, of methane and ethane columns at our site. And what you see is that methane and ethane are highly correlated in the morning. In the morning, the meteorology, again, as I alluded to earlier, the winds are coming from the southeast where we have this coal bed methane and wells. We know we have this activity. In the afternoon, when it switches to the southwest winds, we know that there's not a lot of activity there. And so the correlation breaks down. There's still some methane. There could be some other agricultural sources. So this is some of the evidence we have of the regional character of both where the emissions are, and things add up with the meteorology. If you look at the ethane-methane correlations here, they are reasonably tight in the regional scale, and the slope is about 1.5%. And we have many days of data on this. So as you all know, the methane-to-ethane ratio is obviously an indicator of fossil sources. And also more on that, coal and things on the surface have lower methane to ethane than things like oil and gas. So I think this is indicative of more coal. We can't prove it, but I think I'm digging in a little bit deeper on that. I think in-situ measurements will provide you more information on that. But this is kind of proof that this is oil and gas related in that region. This wasn't shown in the paper, and we're trying to write this up now for GRL. So in closure for the methane story, I've added our point, Four Corners, both in the fluxes and the top-down versus rock-down. And we're a factor of 3.5 or so higher than Edgar. The new RAP and EPA inventories do better jobs, so there the bias is about 1.8 to 1.9. So let me switch gears now to the CMS project. Here the goal of the project was to... So I've shown on the right-hand side, there's a picture of the TCON. It's a big 20-foot controller with an FTS that is pretty big and pumps and all that stuff to follow TCON standards. On the bottom, on that same picture, I've shown you the EM27 Sun that is has lower resolutions, slightly different. It's a pendulum FTR. It's more compact. It's kind of like a portable computer, very light. Its resolution is a lot lower. So what we've done is for the CMS is we've already done is we've taken our this EM27 Sun mobile FTS to four TCON sites at Four Corners, Los Alamos, Armstrong, and Caltech, and we've compared the two at these for week-long periods, and I've shown you some data on the right, and all I can say is the results are very promising, here are some comparisons on the EM27 TCON. Obviously, there are offsets and bias, but the bottom line is for all the sites we've visited, there seems to be decent agreement both for CO2 and methane with some biases that we're still trying to correct for. The resolution of the instrument is lower. It's half a wave number compared to 0.02. And so that's issued some uncertainties. And the other issue is we don't measure the ILS in situ as the TCON does. So we want to make sure those stability are there. The last slide actually gives you some concerns about the CO2 and I think methane also. And here I show you the difference between the IFS, the TCON versus the EM27, the mobile, as a function of solar zenith. So I think there is evidence that high solar zenith, the EM27, may have a low CO2 bias, and we're actually fixing this right now, both empirically with the GGG retrievals and using a priori methods. So I think I'm pretty excited, actually, Paul Wenberg's group has an EM27 Sun as does the Harvard group that has two of these, as do we. We had the first, and we all converged on LA last week or last month and did a sort of intercomparison of all the four instruments and also dispersed them in the Los Angeles area, actually more in the Chino agriculture area. So there's some data that may feed into the Heather's project. So in conclusion, I think we've sort of looked at mesoscale atmospheric emission verification. We verified NO2, CO2 from the power plant emissions. We've looked at the emission factors. The WARF simulations agree with SEMS to within 5%. And McCain et al. Noted in their study in PNAS in 2012 that the meteorological noise on surface sites in Utah was a problem. And I think some of these mesoscale measurements get around that problem. Or you can have a dense network. That's the other solution. But it needs to be determined how many you need. And that's I think the mesoscale mean measurements have an advantage. I think this Cort et al. Paper has created this impact, and there's a lot of follow-up activity to find the source here. I think ethane being used as a signature is very important. Just to mention, we can also do carbonate sulfide, and we're actually trying to get ready to do that in Brazil. And carbonate sulfide, just like ethane, is a tracer for methane emissions from fossil activity. Carbonate sulfide is a tracer that can isolate photosynthesis in large-scale ecosystems like the rainforest. I think the mini FTS is very promising. I came back from Karlsruhe, and the next step we have is Karlsruhe has built a glass dome that can make this system automated, autonomous, and we're thinking about trying to put it in the Arctic. That's the next challenge. So we hope to work with NASA and others to do that. And then the Amazon rainforest monitoring is ongoing. We're excited about that. And the mini FTS TCON comparisons are promising. So that's about it. Thank you.
Thanks, Dubé. We can take questions. There's about 15 minutes left in the hour. I might start and just ask you about the ethane measurements.
Sure.
So it's interesting how it seemed like over your diurnal cycle you had a much stronger drop in ethane than methane, and you mentioned there may be some other sources of methane. So is there agriculture around the site, or have you identified where that could be coming from?
There is agriculture. So we haven't gone and done, so that's what we're in the process of doing. There is agriculture. There are cows. There's grazing going on in that region. And, so I think that's something we're looking at. But it's not vegetated. There is also a river there, so there is a little bit of vegetation, but there's cows and agriculture in that region.
Okay, and then what you're showing for that plot is just is that one day, or that's aggregated measurements?
It's one day. It's a diurnal profile for one day I'm showing.
Okay.
So it's one day, but we have data we did this for 2 weeks, so we have a 2 week data. It depends a lot on the meteorology, so it's modulated by these changing winds. and you see, so there are some dips even within the structure, right? So even before, you see some dips in the high period, and they are also probably wind shifting. So we have to do a little bit more analysis on when you go from the state of winds from the southeast to the southwest, you get those dips also.
Thanks. Yeah, sounds like more to come. That's exciting.
Yeah. More work to do.
Hey, Dubé, this is John.
Hey, John.
I have a question going back to the first part of your talk about the comparing the WARF, the CO2 runs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's slide 21, actually.
Yeah.
WARF columns versus FTS columns. So what did you do for the upper atmosphere CO2 in WARF? Because, of course, this is to do an apples-to-apples comparison with the FTS, you need to assume something about the stratosphere, where the tropopause is, et cetera, that gradient is.
Yeah, I think in this case, in the WARF, we actually assumed that during this period that was relatively a constant over these 2 hours. So we used the TCON measures it, and the WARF modeled it, so I think we pretty much used a flat we assume that the signal was dominated by the boundary layer.
Right, but if it's a full, so you have to assume something in the model,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I noticed your Wharf model went up to 20 kilometers, so
right.
It captures the stratosphere, troposphere, stratosphere.
Well, what you're saying is we're missing a 10% or so. Yeah, I think we make sure we're comparing apples and apples.
Okay.
So, but it was obviously adjusted to make sure that that's not, you know. That's not a bias. Now, again, I would take this, you know, I would focus more on delta CO2 changes versus absolute CO2 changes.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, and on short time scales.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. That's a very good point.
Dubey, this is Arlen. I have a related question, and you might have said it, but if you did, I missed it. My viewer isn't helping me out with the slide number, but it's the one that shows the XCO2 versus NO2.
Yeah.
And so some of the scatter, especially in the panel B for the San Juan, I guess, I was wondering what, you know, if some of that scatter might be due to things that you're neglecting, like biospheric fluxes or stratospheric, you know, assumptions, boundaries.
Absolutely. I think we did a very, you know, data-driven analysis, so I think that could be the possibility. And also, you know, there, it's a mixed source region. It's not really a very clean two power plant region. I mean, we tried to segregate these by meteorology, but you can see on the east, there's a lot, I mean, there are two cities there with a lot of traffic. So, you know, you can't really orthogonalize as easily as I've shown here.
Right.
So some of it is, as you said, meteorological and these errors, but some of this is real mixed sources. It's two power plants plus a city.
Yeah, I think it's really compelling. I'm just curious the extent to which some of that scatter might be reduced, if you could model out the parts that are external.
Yeah, I mean, there was some question to actually do some sort of more rigorous Wharf still type of analysis and attribute and improve, reduce the scatter. We were after just seeing the big slope difference, which is no surprise, you know. And
sure,
there is very
low-hanging fruit.
But there is a, you can see in the middle slide, the variability, the slopes are, you know, factor two, you know, right? There is a variability of factor two.
Hi, Dubai. Here's Jia Chen from Harvard University.
Hi, Jia.
Hi. So I just have a question, your last slide about the difference between TCON and EM27. Isn't that high, is that not high CO2 bias at high dollar 2-minute angle? So because it's just about your title and what you said, because I think at high dollar tinted angle, one, the sun is basically low and optically thick, the gas absorption and the instrument line function has more, or inaccurate instrument line function has more influence on the retrieval result.
Okay.
So basically, I'm thinking you are talking about high CO2 bias at high dollar tinted angle. Right?
That's correct.
Oh.
Sorry. I think my title is.
Yeah.
My title is actually what I meant is not. I see your point. So I think all I'm saying is CO2 in the EM27 sun is lower, but you're right. The bias increases absolutely, and you know a lot more about this. And you may want to add something how your campaign went just for the, you know, you were there also. This is data before the campaign, so this is old data. You guys are still analyzing the data.
Right, yeah, sure. Okay.
Did you see the same issues, or your zenith angles were pretty high, pretty low?
Yes. Yeah, so basically, as I said, at high dollar zenith angle, and the instrument life function has more influence on the retrieval, and therefore, inaccurate instrument life function information would result in higher bias between the TCON and EM27.
Okay. Gia, I did, I saw, so I talked to Frank Haza last month, and he basically has, they saw the same bias in the Giese paper, and now he has modified Prophet beta version, and he's pretty confident he has fixed the problem. So his new line shapes, with his new line shapes and broadening, now can sort of basically get around the bias. So the beta version of Prophet, doesn't, you know, this bias goes away.
Okay, I think the problem is whether for the M27, you are not quite sure about your instrument life function, so it's not every EM27 is ideal aligned, like from Hathersoup, because he's aligning himself, and which results in ideal parameters, like modulation efficiency equals one and no phase error at all. But for the EM27 in North America, we have not ideal instrument line function, which need to take into account, and which can be done in PROFIT if we basically insert the measured instrument line function parameters. Right now, unfortunately, GFIT cannot allow us to put in a not ideal instrument line function parameter for EM27.
I talked to the other thing is actually the instrument that we got, the first one, was very well aligned and it's been very stable. And looks like the instruments you got for some reason did not go to Frank for validation and alignment.
Yeah.
You may want to talk to Frank because he wasn't happy about it.
Yeah, I already showed him some results, my measurement result of the instrument line function, and it's further to the ideal shape than yours, according to our characterization in CARTEC 1 month ago. So you probably are right. Your instrument is better aligned than at least one of ours. Yeah.
And there's a protocol, I think this Cocoon network that Frank and we are part of, I think we have to sort of fix all these things. And I know you guys did a laboratory water line shape. So I think the protocols will develop and the data will get better.
Sure. Yeah. We are working on that. I'm working on that. And thank you.
Thanks for your comments.
Thank you.